The post-resurrection appearances of Jesus happened in various locations according to the Gospels. He appeared to two of the disciples on a road from Jerusalem to Emmaus. He appears still again in the breaking of the bread on a beachside where he shares in a fish fry. He appears to the women in the form of a gardener or of an angel, which is just another word for messenger. And the one thing that all of the various appearances he appears to the disciples through locked doors and closed rooms lets them touch him. And these appearances all have one thing in common. They all occur in human form. The resurrected Christ appears in human form. But what's interesting is that he did not look like the Jesus of Nazareth that they had seen and had been with for 3 years. This raises the distinct possibility that the post-resurrected Jesus still comes to us in human form to this day, though not as the same human form that disciples saw. It's often easy to think that there are no more appearances of the risen Christ, that happened once and for all 2,000 years ago, because we do not see weak, ordinary people changing society the way that Jesus changed his society or the way that the disciples changed their society following the resurrection. But if you listen closely, as Jesus says, with ears to hear and with eyes to see, to a story like the one I'm going to share with you today, hopefully you'll begin to see the image of Christ still breaking down the barriers of sin today, just as they did back in the day, and death that would seek us to separate us one from the other. This is a story of a group of 10 young Irish working class women and one young man, all between the ages of 17 and 25. They worked for a shop called The Dunes. It was a grocery store on Henry Street in Dublin in 1984. And while these young women and this young man were working there as clerks on the floor of the grocery store, they came to make a difference in the fight against apartheid in South Africa, the likes of which they had no conception of what they would be doing. If you don't know what apartheid is, if you're too young for that, it's an African word that means state of being separate, apart. A system of racial segregation in South Africa enforced through legislation by the National Party government between the years 1948 to 1994. I heard this story as told by Karen Giron. She was one of the 10 Irish women involved in this most amazing story of self-sacrifice for a greater good, for a whole nation's greater good, that helped end South Africa's system of apartheid. These 10 people. If you want to hear the story in its entirety, you can find it on public radio's program, The Moth. It's a great storytelling program. I invite you now to sit back, to relax, and to just listen to Karen's story. And this is how she tells it. I wish I had an Irish lilting accent to give you. I'm 20 years of age. I'm the shop steward of Dunes Store in Dublin. And I received instructions from our union saying that we were no longer to handle South African produce. We knew very little about South Africa. We didn't know how to spell or even pronounce the word apartheid. But we followed the union's instructions and informed management that we were going to be following these instructions. And we were immediately put on cash registers. I remember sitting there with my coworkers looking at each other as this woman walked amongst the aisles with two grapefruits from South Africa, that she came up to one of the checkout lines, and we all were praying that she wouldn't come to us, but she did come to one of us. She came to Mary Manning, and Mary Manning refused to handle South African produce and was suspended for this action by the management. And so we went out on strike that day, and it was the 19th of July, 1984, at 12:15 in the afternoon, on Thursday. And I remember it well that day, because that was the day that the Dunes store went on strike. And as I said, we didn't know much about apartheid or what it really involved. We knew that it had to do something with discrimination, but we didn't know anything about the actual system in South Africa. And we were on the picket line for a couple of days when a gentleman by the name of Nimrod shows up on the picket line and starts telling us what it's like to be black and live in South Africa. He was black, and he had lived in South Africa his whole life until just 10 years ago when he came to Ireland to escape the apartheid system. And he told us what it was like to be black and live under apartheid. You couldn't sit in the same seat that a white person sat in. You couldn't use the same toilet that a white person used. You had to be out of cities and towns that white people lived in as a majority group by a certain time every night. And you had to have a passbook to leave your own township to travel to another township. And he described apartheid in the best way that I've ever heard. He described apartheid as a pint of Guinness, stout. The majority of the people are black, and so they live at the bottom of the glass. Actually, they fill up 3/4 of the glass, just like the pint of Guinness. And at the top of those black people are the white people, just like the foam on the top of a pint of Guinness. That's what apartheid is like. And because of Nimrod, this now became personal for us. It was no longer some abstraction that we were dealing with. No longer was it just a union mandate. We were never going to handle South African goods again, we told ourselves, until apartheid was gone and freedom for everyone in South Africa had been achieved. Our union representative told us that we'd be on the strike or the picket line for maybe a couple of weeks. 6 months later, and living on half of what we used to make, we got an invitation from Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa, somebody I got to spend 48 hours with, actually, saying that he wanted to meet with us in London. He was coming over from America on his way to Oslo, Norway, to pick up his Nobel Peace Prize. And he said, I'd like to meet with the Dunn store workers. And I remember being in London, and it was the first time we really had any media interest in what we were doing whatsoever. Everybody up to this point had pretty well ignored us. And then this tiny little man, and that's so true, with a high squeaky voice, comes over and he hugs us and tells the media how proud he is of us. And for somebody like that to say something like that to us just brought us even more passion for what we were doing than we had even before this. And he told us that what we were doing was going to go back to South Africa, and that when he went back to South Africa, he was going to tell ordinary workers all over the country in South Africa what other ordinary people were doing in other parts of the world on their behalf, so they would know that they were not on their own in this fight, this struggle. They were people out in the world who cared enough to do something about apartheid and not just talk about it. And then on the first anniversary of the strike, 1 year after it began, when we were getting very little support from the government in Ireland or the Irish people or even the trade union movement, but we stuck to our guns, and Bishop Desmond Tutu asked us to come to South Africa to see for ourselves what apartheid was all about. And we had no money whatsoever to go to South Africa, because when we were working, we earned around £85 per week, roughly about the same in terms of US dollars back in the 80s. And now on strike, we were living off of £21 per week, $21 roughly a week. The union was only able to give us £1,000, but the trip was going to cost us about £8,000. A lot of money. So we got everybody in Dublin who was sympathetic to us to help us by giving us one full day to hit all of the pubs in Dublin. And we raised £7,000 in 1985 dollars from ordinary working class people just like us so that we could go to South Africa and see with our own eyes what this was about. The trip was organized and we headed off to Heathrow International Airport. Now, as Irish and British citizens, all we require to visit South Africa is a current passport and a return airplane ticket. But when we arrived at Heathrow in London, we were informed by British Airways officials that we would not be allowed to board the plane because they had been informed by South African embassy officials that we now, today, have to also have a visa to enter into South Africa. British Airway officials then requested us to surrender our boarding passes and get off the plane, and when we refused to do so, they threatened to call the police. They told everybody on the plane why we were being held up on the tarmac, because of us, that it was our fault. And finally, after 3 hours of sitting in a delay, they allowed us to finally board the plane. When we arrived in Johannesburg, we left the plane and found that there was a line of soldiers on either side of the tarmac, carrying machine guns, each with a German Shepherd. And at the time, we just simply thought this was normal procedure. But in fact, they were there for us. And when we joined the line to get our passports checked, we were approached by British Airway officials and asked if we were the group from Dublin. And we told them that we were. And we were immediately surrounded by South African security forces, which accompanied us up 6 flights of stairs to an undisclosed part of the building. And there we were detained for 8 hours. During this time, we requested to be allowed to contact our families to tell them that we were still here and that we were okay and safe, and they refused to let us do that. We also asked to speak to the Irish consulate and the British embassy officials. The Irish consulate was refused entry to us, but the British embassy official was allowed up. He stated that if it was political, the reason for our visit, he did not want to know about it. He told a woman who was a British citizen in our group that, in his opinion, we were being treated very well by the South African forces, and if we had been anywhere else, we would probably have been thrown in jail somewhere and left without food or anything else. He also informed her that he would contact her family, but said it was not his concern to deal with the other members of the group. If we had to go to the toilet, we had to have an escort of 2 South African security women accompany us, and the door not only to the bathroom, but to the stall left open in full view of everybody while we went to the bathroom. After approximately 5 hours, we asked whether we could change our clothes and put on something fresh. Before we were allowed to do so, our cases and our hand baggage were searched thoroughly, and all personal letters and diaries were opened and read. We finally persuaded British airline officials to contact our families to tell them that we were safe and we were being sent home on the next plane. At 6:30 in the evening, armed guards finally escorted us back to the plane. And I remember being both relieved, because I knew we were going home where it would be safe, and angry at the same time. And the last words that I spoke from the very top of the airline steps before we actually got on the plane itself was, "We will be back to South Africa when it is free." At which point my friend Sandra, one of the strikers, pushed me through the door into the plane and told me to shut up. Remember, we were only 20 years old, 2 years younger than Michelle, who's 22 today. The youngest of the 10 of us was 17, and the oldest was 25. We were young, we were scared, we had no idea what we were in for. When we arrived back in London, we were also greeted there by armed security guards, and we thought, oh my gosh, we're going to have to go through the same thing now here in London. But instead, we were escorted off the plane and into a room where the world's press awaited us. They wanted to hear from us what was going on in South Africa, and they were there from America, from the United Kingdom, from all over the world. And there was a headline that read, "The most dangerous people in the world." The most dangerous people in the world. And that was the Dunstore Strikers, 10 women and 1 man. The most dangerous people in the world. When we got home to Ireland, there was a mass picket that had been organized. Now, up to that moment, there was very little support for the Dunstore Strikers in Ireland. A lot of people paid lip service to what we were doing, but there was really very little support. But on that day, on the day that we arrived back in Dublin, there were 73,000 people on Henry Street joining the picket. And we couldn't walk up or down the street at all because of the number of people supporting 11 strikers. So thank you to the South African government for kicking us out and bringing all this attention upon us. Then in October of 1985, the most amazing thing happened. We were invited to come to New York to address the United Nations. And here we were, all of us, these store clerks, these common people, being invited to visit and talk to the most important people in the entire world. And after I gave my speech in the entire chamber, stood in unison in applause. It was the very first time in the history of the United Nations that the world's representatives had stood in applause because we were just ordinary, everyday people, not government officials, not rich, not powerful by any standards, standing up for what was right. Eventually, the government started to take some notice of us, and they brought in a boycott of all South African goods into Ireland. When we started the strike, there was just two anti-apartheid movements in Ireland. By the time the strike ended, which was 2 years after it had began and 9 months, there were 36 anti-apartheid groups that formed as Dunn Store support groups throughout the entire country. And in 1987, Ireland became the first Western democracy to put a boycott in place of all South African goods, all because of 11 ordinary people. And that was a result of the Dunn Store strikers, 10 women and one man. Then we all started to drift apart, and we tried to get on with our lives as normal people try to get on with their lives. And we were all watching the day that it was announced that Nelson Mandela was being released from prison in South Africa. And each of us who was watching this on television thought to ourselves, now, wow, did we ever think we would get to see this day occur? And then we find out that Nelson Mandela wants to come to Ireland, and he wants to meet us, the Dunn Store strikers. This is our hero coming to see us. This is the symbol of a new South Africa, and he wants to come and meet us. And when we met him, oh, and he was so very, very tall, I thought, oh my God, you are the person I've always wanted to meet in my life. And now you are standing here right in front of me. And he shook hands with us, and it was totally surreal. And he said to us, you are so brave. And he gave us his Medal of Bravery, the medal that had been given to him. He gave to us and put it around our neck. And when he did this, all of the bad feelings, all of the hurts that we went through at that Dunn Store just totally fell away because he had acknowledged what we had done. Years later, we got word with the rest of the world that Nelson Mandela had died. And we went to the embassy in Ireland to sign the book of condolences. And before we left to go and sign the book, I received a phone call that said, the operator on the other end said, you might just want to bring your passport. And so I grabbed it, and I thought, okay. And when we all arrived, all of us, the strikers from various parts of Ireland, at the consulate, all of us who had started this strike were invited to be part of the official delegation to attend President Nelson Mandela's funeral from Ireland. We were going with the president of our country to visit the president of another country. 10 women, one man, all ordinary people like you and me. And when we arrived in South Africa at that same airport, now all these decades later, all of the Dunn Store strikers were there, and South Africa was at last free. This is but just one example, folks, of where you can find the risen Christ today. Get your eyes open to see where else it's happening in the world. Amen.
Thank you. touch his hands.